Circuit live in New York City. I'm your host, Patrick Giacomo. I'm a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, filling in for my colleague and friend, Anya Bidwell, who is truly irreplaceable, so please bear with me. We're recording tonight from the mezzanine, a beautiful event space just feet from Wall Street, perhaps fitting since the Second Circuit, by virtue of its location in Manhattan, has its fair share of massive financial litigation. But we won't bore you with that, I promise. We have quite a fascinating selection of cases for you and an amazing panel to discuss them. It is my pleasure to introduce them to you tonight. First, Marin Shah is a partner at the one and only Quinn Emanuel, a firm with a legendary reputation among law students dreaming about and living in fear of life as a high-intensity litigator. Marin is a seasoned trial lawyer with extensive experience handling complex commercial disputes. She leads the firm's art litigation practice and its insurance practice and has published chapters in an acclaimed textbook on business and commercial litigation in federal courts. Marin clerked for the Honorable Robert D. Sack on the Second Circuit, and she's a visiting faculty member at Stanford Law School. Welcome, Marin.
Thank you, Patrick. Nice to be here.
Second, Bruce Green is the Lewis Stein Chair at Fordham Law School, where he directs the Lewis Stein Center for Law and Ethics. He teaches and writes primarily in the areas of legal ethics and criminal law. His recent articles include Who Should Police the Politicization of DOJ in the Notre Dame Journal of Law, Ethics, and Public Policy, Victims' Rights from a Restorative Perspective in the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law, and Punishment Without Process, Victim Impact Proceedings for Dead Defendants in Fordham Law Review. Over his career, Bruce has also taken on a number of public service engagements, including as associate counsel in the office of the Iran-Contra prosecutor. Bruce also served as chief appellate attorney in the Southern District of New York and was a judicial law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall and Second Circuit Judge James L. Oakes. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Finally, Alex Reinert is the Max Freund Professor of Litigation and Advocacy at Cardozo Law School and its director at the Center for Rights and Justice. Alex teaches and conducts research in the areas of civil procedure, constitutional law, criminal law, federal courts, and the law of prisons and jails. His articles have appeared in numerous prestigious publications, with a lot of recent scholarship focusing on qualified immunity. His recent paper in the California Law Review is about qualified immunity's flawed foundation, and I'm hoping we can talk about that a little more later. He's also conducted the most comprehensive study of qualified immunity on appeal. Alex has cases in the Second Circuit and the Supreme Court. He argued Ashcroft versus Iqbal. Alex clerked for the Honorable Harry T. Edwards of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and then with the United States Supreme Court Justice Stephen G. Breyer. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks, Patrick. It's great to be here.
So since we are in the Second Circuit, most of our discussion will be in that context. So I want to ask everyone on this panel about their experience in the Second Circuit. But first, I think we need to give the audience just a bit of an overview on the circuit. The Second Circuit covers three states, Connecticut, Vermont, and New York. The court sits in Manhattan and is considered one of the most prestigious and influential in the country. The court's had its fair share of legendary judges, including Judge Learned Hand, who served on the court from 1921 to 1964, and Judge Henry Friendly, Chief Justice Roberts' former boss, on the court from 1959 to 1986. Justice Sonia Sotomayor on the Supreme Court served as a judge on the Second Circuit before her appointment to the Supreme Court. And who can forget Judge Guido Calabresi, to whom we will return later in the program. There are 13 active seats in the Second Circuit, all of which are presently filled, six by Republican appointees and seven by Democratic appointees. But enough of me talking, let's put our panelists on the spot. Marin, can I begin with you?
Of course.
What was it like to clerk for Judge Sack, who, just like Judge Calabresi, currently has senior status but still very active on the bench?
He is very active and always has been, and actually I'm pleased that the opinion I'll be discussing tonight is one of his, which I always enjoy. You know, it was a really wonderful experience, as I think many clerks will probably tell you. The Second Circuit, at least during my time there, was a very collegial court, both within the chambers, between the judge and the law clerks, and between chambers, between the judges and clerks. You know, as we all know, it's down here in, I guess, what you might call federal, you know, judiciary square, to have a throwback reference to D.C. It used to be, at least when I was there, in the same building as the Southern District. It's down here with the New York State Courts as well, City Hall, the prosecutor's offices, federal and state. And so you really kind of get to know everybody in this ecosystem, which is quite impressive. And, you know, something that was really notable about my time there, I suppose, is that we, you know, my year, the judge had four clerks, one of whom he adopted from Sonia Sotomayor's chambers before she, you know, around the time that she was elevated to the Supreme Court. We were all very close, both among each other and with the judge. You know, I keep in close touch with the judge today. Was emailing with him last week for his birthday. You know, I know his family and his wife quite well. He knows my family, my kids. It really was quite a special and formative experience, both personally and professionally. And, you know, I would say a little known piece of inside baseball, I suppose, which is exemplary of the circuit, is that they all tend to call each other by acronyms, their initials, right? So Robert D. Sack is RDS, Robert A. Katzman is RAK, and so on. And so the judges call each other that way. They refer to each other that way. They call their clerks by their initials as well. So you have to very quickly learn everybody's acronym to know what's, you know, who anybody's talking about in the court. But I think that exemplifies kind of the spirit of collegiality that the judges have with each other, and that was really a hallmark of my time on the circuit.
Did the clerks use those acronyms for each other or the judges?
Yes. Still to this day.
Well, if you're not saying judge first, then it must be pretty collegial.
It definitely is.
Bruce, you clerked for Judge Oaks a few years before Marin was clerking on the court, I think.
Before she was in elementary school, maybe.
Could you tell us about the influence that he still has on you and your experience clerking for him?
Well, I you know, first of all, it was my first job out of law school. So, and I still think it's the best job one could possibly have out of law school. And a lot of my experience was similar to Marin's, and some of it was different. He was sitting in Vermont. Vermont has traditionally had just one Court of Appeals judge. He had actually clerked for the Court of Appeals judge on the Learned Hand Court when he was out of Harvard, and which made him feel even more, you know, you talk about collegiality, but he felt this connection going back decades to the court, and I think his love of the court, you know, partly grew out of that. And so it wasn't, you know, you talk about the ecosystem in New York, and I do think if you're a law clerk in New York, you get to know the judges and the judges' law clerks in a way. We come down 1 week a month, and, you know, we would have lunch with the law clerks for the other judges, both district and Court of Appeals judges. But otherwise, we didn't really have that much interaction with the other judges, but we had an amazing amount of interaction with Judge Oaks, JLO, because we were in Brattleboro, Vermont, and he had lunch with us, you know, a couple times a week. And his secretaries came along. One of his secretaries, Cynthia Fairchild, had been with him since he was in law practice. He had been in a two-person practice in Brattleboro, and she was still taking notes shorthand and then typing up the opinions. And one thing that I think was a little different about Judge Oaks was that he wrote his own opinions. And you know, you could say whatever you want about the Second Circuit judges, but the truth is, when I was clerking, at least, the law clerks were, you know, doing the first drafts and having a lot of input. And when I was, you know, clerking for Justice Marshall, the same was true. But he was very old school, and so he would take the memos, bench memos, and the briefs, and he would dictate the opinion to Cynthia, and she would type it out, and then we would edit it. So that was a little different. But I kind of, you know, was terrified the following year when I was clerking for Justice Marshall because Judge Oaks only let us each write one opinion. The last sitting, we each got an opinion where we got to do the first draft, and you know, and all of a sudden I was going to be put in this position where I actually had to write these opinions. But in any event, biggest thing I learned from him, honestly, was not about the law so much, but about how to treat people within law practice. He had been you know, politician. He was state attorney general. He knew the names of everybody. He was treated everybody the same, no matter who they were. And he was, you know, he was unbelievably civil. And, you know, he referred to his law clerks as the children of my intellect. and we were like, you know, part of his family. We were part of the extended family. We had reunions regularly. I'm still in touch with his wife. It was a third wife, and so she's my age. And it was, you know, it, you know, set me on a course where I, when I try to mentor my students and work with younger people, I think about the judge. When I think about the respect he showed to everybody, including pro se litigants, you know, I think about the importance of treating people civilly, you know, within the law. They may win, they may lose, but you have to treat them respectfully. So in any event, I should stop, but it was obviously, I think you could probably get the sense, a very meaningful experience for me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Alex, you clerked for a DC Circuit judge and then on the Supreme Court, but you have argued quite a few cases in the Second Circuit. What has your experience been like, and what do you think makes the Second Circuit stand out from the others?
Well, so for sure, the judges are always prepared. There's no question about that. And every case I've argued has stretched well beyond the time that was allotted to it. So I think almost every argument I've had has gone at least an hour. Now, you know, when you're talking about arguing Iqbal, we argued Iqbal in the Second Circuit before it went up to the Supreme Court. You can understand why that goes for an hour. But I had a case in the last year that was a case out of Rikers involving an incarcerated person who had not received adequate medical care. That case went on for an hour, too. So maybe it's just me. But they go on for a while. And also, maybe it's just me, but almost every one of my cases has prompted separate opinions. In fact, the first case I ever argued, I lost, of course, 3-0, but each judge felt compelled to write about why I should lose. They couldn't quite agree about why I should lose, but they all agreed I should lose. And so I think it's the intellectual sort of atmosphere of the circuit. You see it when you argue the cases, the curiosity, the willingness to hear you out. So that's my perception, that's my experience having argued there multiple times.
Great, thanks. Well, let's stick with you, and we're gonna move into the discussion of the cases, all of which are, of course, Second Circuit decisions that were issued recently. So could you introduce McKinney versus City of Middletown?
Sure. McKinney is a case involving excessive force. Mr. McKinney was arrested by officers of the Middletown Police Department in Connecticut for attempting to rob a subway. And he had consumed alcohol and various psychiatric medications and some drugs and was in some distress. And following his arrest, he was placed in a holding cell and then displayed some concerning behavior to the officers, covering the cell camera with toilet paper, trying to engage in self-harm. And the officers decided to transfer him out of that cell. And that's really where the conflict started. The officers, before they decided to transfer him, brought a canine to the scene. McKinney said he wouldn't leave. And when the defendants, the officers who were sued, opened the door, McKinney resisted, conceded by McKinney. And then the officers escalated their use of force, used batons, used tasers, used the canine immediately. And eventually McKinney was significantly injured as a result of this use of force. Indeed, they didn't release the dog from Mr. McKinney until he was in handcuffs, even though he had stopped resisting at that point. And so he sued for excessive force. And this is a case that had been up to the circuit once, and the circuit had reversed a grant of summary judgment. And in that reversal had said, a reasonable jury can find that the use of force here was unreasonable, but didn't address qualified immunity. And so went back to the district court on qualified immunity, and the district court granted summary judgment on qualified immunity, and it went back up to the circuit again. Now, one thing that happened was the oral argument was before Katzman, Menasche, and Calabresi. Judge Katzman sadly died, and Judge Raji took his place, which, if anyone knows the circuit, knows that that changes, frankly, the complexion of the panel. And so the panel, over a dissent Judge Calabresi affirmed the decision to dismiss the case on qualified immunity grounds. And for those of us who know what qualified immunity means, there's really two inquiries. One is, what was the clearly established law? Second, did the officers behave reasonably in light of the clearly established law? And probably the most critical part of the court's opinion was to say it wasn't clearly established that it was unconstitutional to use canine force after Mr. McKinney ceased actively resisting. And this is where the court says, well, yes, there was case law saying that it's unconstitutional to initiate the use of force against someone who's not resisting. That's different from case law that says it's unconstitutional to continue using force after someone stops resisting. This is the classic problem in qualified immunity of trying to figure out exactly what it means when you say law is clearly established and how specific the right has to be and how specific the case law has to be. And this is an example of a panel very strictly applying those rules to say, we need a case on point. You don't have a case on point, even though you have cases involving use of force, you don't, and use of canine force. You don't have a case involving use of canine force on these particular facts. And of course, Justice Calabresi dissented. And in his dissent, really issued a broadside against qualified immunity, citing some of my scholarship, citing some of Will Bode's scholarship, some of Joanna Schwartz's scholarship, and saying, we need to do away with this doctrine, while recognizing that as an appeals court, he really lacked the authority to do away with the doctrine. Really was a plea to the Supreme Court or to Congress. So that's essentially what happened in the case.
Yeah, so one of the things that I thought was interesting and I wanted to ask the panel about is one of the criticisms that Judge Calabresi makes in his dissent is that the panel here is essentially bound by the law of the case from the earlier decision, saying, you know, there's at least a question of fact as far as whether there was a constitutional violation here. And Judge Calabresi says that he interprets the majority's opinion here as essentially using qualified immunity to get around the fact that it can't say that there was no constitutional violation. And so I was hoping you could speak to the way that qualified immunity essentially allows courts to avoid addressing constitutional merits.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is an unusual case in that normally when qualified immunity comes up, if we know that the law isn't clearly established, the court can just address that question rather than addressing whether or not the conduct violated the law in the first place. And this is a failing of qualified immunity. It means the law doesn't develop. But in this case, because the panel had found already that the conduct as alleged, a reasonable jury could find that it was a violation of the Constitution, the new panel was bound by that. And indeed, in a way, I think Justice Calabresi is, I'll call it a judo move, right? He says, well, this is a quote, I can't help but notice that the majority at times seems to doubt that the use of force it describes was really unreasonable. In other words, they seem to be wanting to revisit what the original panel said, but they can't. And so then he says, and so it would seem from now on in our circuit that the use of force described by the majority, a calibrated escalation in response to resistance in the close confines of a holding cell, is unconstitutionally excessive. That would be a remarkable holding, he says, and might well, for purposes of qualified immunity, be a new and unexpected one. So he's trying to turn, he's doing what he can in this dissent to turn the majority's reading against them to say, well, at least you've now said, as a matter of clearly established law, the use of calibrated escalation in response to resistance now is clearly unconstitutional. But it speaks to the problem you've identified, which is, in general, qualified immunity interferes with the development of the law in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been something that's an interesting observation that's been obviously true. I mean, last term, I think we saw two summary reversals by the Supreme Court in qualified immunity cases involving excessive force claims. And both of them struck me in a similar way to the majority here as situations where the court could have just said there's no constitutional violation under the Fourth Amendment because the force was reasonable, but instead they disposed of the cases using qualified immunity. And as Judge Calabresi points out, that means that the law hardly develops at all if it does indeed develop. To the rest of the panel, does that trouble you from a constitutional advancement standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is something that is troubling. And this, you know, this is an area for me which is somewhat outside my wheelhouse, although Alex and Patrick gave me a good tutorial on qualified immunity before this panel, which is fascinating, so I'm very interested in it now. You know, it is certainly a doctrine of judicial efficiency and prudence to dispose of cases at the threshold procedural gating issue and not at the merits if you can avoid reaching the merits. And I do think, you know, federal court judges are quite sensitive to that. The Second Circuit is very sensitive to that, and I think very prudent in not trying to, in most cases, overreach and address questions on the merits which may not be essential to the resolution of the issue if there is a threshold procedural question. That seems to me to be the dynamic that's at play oftentimes in these qualified immunity cases from my limited admitted exposure to them. And something that I think is interesting here, as Alex points out, because that's something that Judge Calabresi is clearly you know, railing against to a degree in the limited fashion that he can, given the procedural posture of the case. And it's one of the reasons I found this case really fascinating, not just on the merits, but in terms of what it reveals about the Second Circuit, because I think it's showing you two things that are quite typical of the circuit. The first is that this is a Judge Calabresi special. You know, he is, as many of us know, somewhat left-leaning, to say the least. But more importantly, you know, very thoughtful and very strong-minded, and not remotely afraid to break away from the majority and write dissents. And I think you'll see that kind of, you know, strongly held opinion and prolific writing style in two of the decisions we're discussing tonight. You know, between the three cases, he's written four separate opinions, one majority opinion and concurrence to his own majority opinion, right? And here, he has dissented, and not only dissented, but then written a separate appendix in which he says, you know, quite thoughtfully and carefully, I'm dissenting on the legal merits of the question at issue. But by the way, if I could just throw out some dicta here, I think this doctrine is completely bogus, and I think it should be eradicated, which I think is very interesting. And the other interesting thing about this decision is, as Alex also noted, is Justice Calabresi is quite pointed in saying, you know, among other regrets that he has over the death of Judge Katzmann, one seems to be that he suggests that Katzmann would have joined his majority opinion had he remained on the panel. Mm-hmm. And that, too, I think is telling about the circuit, because although it's not a very politicized court, generally speaking, the constitution of the panel does often matter. The judicial temperaments and judicial orientations of the panels here can be quite outcome determinative in certain cases, and I think you're seeing a reflection of that here.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned both those things, in particular this appendix argument, because it obviously occasioned a section in the majority's brief where they offer a fairly muscular defense of qualified immunity. I mean, at this point, even the Supreme Court, when it applies qualified immunity and actually comments on the doctrine itself, will concede, you know, this is a made-up doctrine that's not based on the common law. And here we see the panel majority kind of try to rehabilitate it a little bit, which was interesting. And Alex, since your work was cited by Judge Calabresi, what do you think about the arguments made by the majority here that qualified immunity has a foundation in the common law?
Well, I think the problem with the majority's argument is it neglects two pieces that I try to excavate in my article. One is that to the extent qualified immunity is a doctrine of statutory interpretation, the mode and the canon of statutory interpretation that the court used to create qualified immunity just is unrecognizable when one looks at that canon in the context in which the 1871 Civil Rights Act was enacted. So specifically, the Supreme Court bases qualified immunity on this canon of construction that says we disfavor implied repeals of the common law. But when you actually look into how that canon was applied from the founding to Reconstruction, it was never applied to imply a defense in a statutorily created right like the 1871 Civil Rights Act. So there's lots of other problems with how the Supreme Court has used the derogation canon in the qualified immunity context, but that's the main problem that I don't think the majority grapples with. And then there's the part of the article that I write about, which is there was language in the 1871 Act that, again, specifically said there shall be liability notwithstanding any state law, custom, et cetera, to the contrary. And since the basis for the common law immunity doctrine that the court initially recognized when it adopted qualified immunity in 1967 was state law, you can't ignore that language if you're really going to be true to what the Reconstruction Congress was trying to accomplish. And then when you put that in the context of all of the evidence that we have about what the Reconstruction Congress was trying to do with the 1871 Civil Rights Act, it's really hard to justify under any textualist or originalist or purposivist interpretation of Section 1983. Pick your approach to interpreting statutes, right? It's incredibly hard to justify a qualified immunity doctrine.
Great. Well, let's move from one mechanism that government officials use to get out of accountability to another. And Bruce, can you tell us a little bit about Jean Carroll versus Donald Trump?
Sure. This is a case that people probably read a little about in the newspaper. Judge Calabresi says this case is about torts and not Trump, but I think it's kind of about Trump. And it's also about statutory interpretation. So there's 80 pages of opinions altogether. Judge Calabresi's majority opinion is 57 pages. As Mara notes, his concurrence to his own majority opinion is three more pages. And then there's a 20-page dissent by Denny Chin. So 80 pages in 5 minutes, that I can't do the math, but I'm probably going to skip a few pages. So Jean Carroll wrote a book in 2019 accusing Donald Trump of rape in a department store dressing room around a quarter century earlier. And Donald Trump, who was president at the time, he didn't need no introduction, held a press conference and did some social media stuff, denying that he had raped Ms. Carroll and also accusing her of lying. And so she filed a defamation action. And this implicated two statutes and two federal statutes and raised two questions of statutory interpretation and one question of state tort law. The first statute was the 1988 Westfall Act, which provides that certain torts, provides that torts by certain government employees and officials, when they commit them, they will be immune from tort liability personally if they did the acts within the scope of their office or employment. And in that case, the action will be against the federal government rather than against them individually. So the idea is, on one hand, to relieve federal government employees and officers personally of the anxiety and the expense of having to defend themselves when they committed torts in the course of their work, but on the other hand, to provide some compensation, a pretty deep pocket, the U.S. government mints money, probably good for a judgment. So the problem here is that for most torts, if it gets kicked to the federal government, then they'll defend the case and they'll pay a judgment. For defamation, what you look to is the Federal Torts Claims Act, and Federal Torts Claims Act provides that there's no defamation actions against the federal government. And so the effect here, if the Westfall Act applies, is that Donald Trump will be personally immune, but on the other hand, the government can't be sued either. And so in this situation, if the Westfall Act applies, the plaintiff, Ms. Carroll, is out of court.
Yeah, Jim Fander calls this the Westfall Shuffle.
A Westfall Shuffle.
So you've got this situation where someone sues a federal official for a tort, The United States government says they were working for us, so you have to sue us instead. But oh, by the way, you can't sue us because it falls into an exception.
And the process is that the Attorney General comes in and certifies that this act was done by a federal official in the course of their work. And not surprisingly, the Attorney General of the United States under the Trump administration came in and filed that certification. So the first question is he an officer of the government who's covered? And this takes up a lot of pages of both the majority and the dissent. The district judge had said he's not because it's just too exhausting for me to explain, honestly.
It's a very philosophical exercise of statutory interpretation.
Well, it would be good for my first-year students in their legislative interpretation course. You know, there's a lot of pages devoted to the, even though the president isn't explicitly included, and it refers to departments, and he's not in a department. The word includes is in the definition, and so the non-inclusion doesn't exclude him because the word includes is inclusive. That's probably more than you want to know already. The majority says the act applies to the president, even though the president isn't explicitly included, largely because after engaging this whole extensive statutory interpretation thing, they say, well, it ends up turning on what the word employee meant back in 1988. An employee is somebody who works for other people, where he worked, you know, Donald Trump works for the U.S. government, blah, blah, blah. The dissenting judge, Judge Chin, says that's not what I think employee means. It's somebody who's under the control of others. He's out of control. Well, no, that's my gloss. He's not under the control. He is the boss. And so he's not an employee. So, but the next question then becomes, was he acting in the course of his employment? And according to prior Supreme Court decisions, that even though that's the a phrase within the statute, you look to the law of the state, the respondeat superior law of the state, and everyone here agreed for whatever reason that the DC law applied. And so the question was, what does DC law say about whether defamation committed in a press conference is when you're a professional employee as a president? Well, of course, that's a question of first and hopefully last impression. There haven't been a lot of presidents who've engaged in defamation in the course of press conferences. And so what the dissenting judge says is, of course, you know, under however you interpret that in DC law, no president is employed for the purpose of defaming people at a press conference, particularly people who were accusing them of wrongdoing in the course of their personal lives prior to being president. We got to send this back for trial. The majority, and Justice Calabresi spends another like 30 or 40 pages on this. Basically, he says, well, if it was clear, we would resolve it, but it's not clear. And in the course of this, I don't think he cites you, Alex, but he does cite himself in three different opinions.
I thought the most Calabresi thing he does is he cites a paper that he wrote 61 years before that.
Yeah, from 1961?
Yeah, yes, about exactly. About torts and frolic and detour.
And I have to say, in my articles, I always cite myself a lot, too. So it's probably only fair. But the point was, whether someone's doing something in the course of their work, you could view it in two different ways. The traditional way, he wasn't. The more modern way, he doesn't really say he was. Yeah. So I don't know why they go through the whole interpretation.
They go through that whole thing, this long disquisition on the D.C. Court of Appeals case law. And I couldn't tell. I mean, it's justifying this first ever certification from the Second Circuit to the D.C. Court of Appeal, right? It's the
That's
first ever time they've
it.
Done it, right?
That's how I took
That's
it.
That's why you took it?
Yes.
Or it's sort of to suggest an answer. You didn't take it as to suggest an answer to the question because it felt like it was skewed a little bit. But.
Yeah, I kind of took it as a full-throated justification for we're not punting an uncomfortable issue. we want to have a long roadmap that justifies certification to a different court. Now it's your problem.
There were a lot of twists and turns because Judge Calabresi goes through every single decision. for the D.C. Court of Appeals, and then a bunch from the D.C. Circuit. He says, well, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. It just goes back and forth and back and forth.
So they say they're applying this test, but when you read their explanation, it looks like that test. And, of course, the D.C. Circuit doesn't really count because it's really the D.C. equivalent of the state law. But nevertheless, maybe it has some insight. And who cares, really? They're certifying the question. And then the concurrence, because he then writes, well, I probably shouldn't be writing this. and you don't really have to pay attention to it. But keep in mind that the reason for the modern rule, which expands employer liability, is so that the employer will internalize the cost. They're the ones who could avoid the risk. They should pay the cost. But it works just the opposite here, because under the Federal Tort Claims Act, there's no defamation action against the government. So rather than having the government internalize the cost, you're putting it back on the defamed individual. And I'm not saying that matters. I'm not saying you should think about it. Why is he writing the?
Right, I have deemed it appropriate. To point to the existence of this recurring and troublesome question, which the D.C. Court of Appeals is, of course, totally free to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because in the dissent, you have this statement that says, the president is in no respect the servant of a master. And that's the discussion of this issue of whether the president's an employee under the Federal Tort Claims Act. But it obviously goes to this sort of more policy-driven question of scope of employment that Judge Calabresi is talking about. Because if there's no master to correct the problem, then this whole internalization concept doesn't really work very well, does it?
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting part of the dissent as well. Because, you know, if you read through the dissent, and as Bruce says, you know, the majority opinion plus concurrence takes some 50-odd pages, and they go through this long judicial history of various doctrines and statutory interpretation. One thing they really don't grapple with, which I thought was quite interesting, that Judge Chin mentions at the end of his dissent, is, you know, putting aside the statutory interpretation about whether he's an employee or not, right? And putting aside the debate on the scope of respondeat superior liability under the D.C. law, whether it's really, you know, benefits the employer or whether it's within the scope of risk. One thing that's undeniable here is that at least some of former President Trump's statements in the press were clearly outside either of those definitions, mm-hmm. right? And he points to, in particular, the one statement that he made that, quote, she's not my type,
right.
And says, you know, under any interpretation of D.C. law, you couldn't plausibly find this statement to be within the scope of anything, right? And that, if you take it to its logical conclusion, should dispose of the issue pretty conclusively. But the majority really doesn't grapple with it at all. And I thought that was a very interesting kind of trains passing in the night situation for a combined opinion of some 80-odd pages.
You know, both of the opinions we've been talking about turn a little bit on how you frame things. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, the AG's position is press conferences are within the scope of the president.
Right.
I don't know what that Twittering is, but maybe, you know, but press conferences are, and therefore whatever he says at the press conference. But that's like saying pizza delivery is within the scope of the Pizza Hut guy's job, and therefore beating up the person to whom you deliver the pizza, that doesn't make any sense to me. And in your opinion, also, it's similar. It's like, is the case about, you know, tasering, beating, and having a dog mangle somebody who's in their pajamas in a jail cell and completely defenseless? Or it's like, does it make a distinction that it was a Doberman and not a Rottweiler? At what level of specificity?
Well, right. That's a situation which the level of specificity, when you scope it down, makes it harder to recover. And this is a situation where the level of specificity, as you scope it up, makes it harder to recover, right? I mean, that's the interesting connection. I can't leave this case without imploring any law clerks to never write a footnote like footnote 2, which is the cleaned up footnote, which basically says, we're just going to assume every time you see a quote here, it may or may not omit citations or other material or foot. It drives me crazy, so I can't.
I flagged that and thought, you know, it would be a lot easier to write briefs if I could just say that
absolutely.
At the outset.
Just footnote 2. Don't worry. I'm just basically approximating what the court said.
I won't even quote things anymore. I'll just paraphrase it all and just assume that it's accurate.
And also ignore Blue Book while we're at it. Since we're talking about process and not the substance of this, so both of these opinions also make me think the judges of the Second Circuit have too much time on their hands. Because why is Judge Calabresi doing this whole thing on a question that they're ultimately certifying to the D.C. Court of Appeals? And why, in the other case,
is he writing
this long appendix? But more so, I would not blame him because he's a senior judge and he can do whatever he wants with his time. But why is the judge in the majority, who's an active judge, then taking on his appendix and writing a whole thing on, like, is it that they all wish they were on the Supreme Court or the job is not interesting and they finally find an issue that they could talk about? Or do they have too many law clerks? Or too much time? I don't get it.
These are the questions I should have been asking. I mean, this is the behind-the-scenes stuff. So, Marin and Alex, tell us, what is the secret here? Why is this happening?
So, my read, at least, of the McKinney case, and I also thought it was very interesting that the majority spent a lot of time addressing the appendix rather than the dissent. Given the questions around the composition of the panel that Judge Calabresi called out in terms of the majority opinion, my read on that was that the majority, to my mind, clearly thought that Judge Calabresi's dissent and perhaps even the first panel's remand was an outcome-oriented result. Meaning, you know, he has strong disagreement with the doctrine such that he backfilled the legal questions to get to the result that he wanted to. That's the read that I took of it. I think, you know, knowing his scholarship and his political orientation, it's not that surprising that the court kind of, or the majority opinion kind of looked through the legal analysis to the result on this one. And I think they were, influenced by that in their treatment of their own majority opinion.
I'll just add one other hypothesis, which is that a lot of judges have been criticizing qualified immunity in opinions like Justice Calabresi, but in majority opinions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of judges who are identified as quote-unquote conservative judges in other circuits have been criticizing qualified immunity for the same reasons that Judge Calabresi does it. And I think these two judges, who also are conservative judges, maybe felt like that's not the only way to go. Here is a model for how you can write a defense of qualified immunity that accounts for some of the arguments that are being made by people like me, by Will Bode, Joanna Schwartz, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on that point in particular because in the appendix, Judge Calabresi has, you know, almost a two-page long citation of all the other judges who have criticized qualified immunity. And there are a lot of big-name conservatives, not only Justice Clarence Thomas, but, you know, Judge Ho in the Fifth Circuit, Judge Willett in the Fifth Circuit, and so on.
So why does he need to do it?
That's a great question. Yeah. All right, before we run out of time, we need to get to Marin's case. So why don't you tell us about United States versus Amalfi, and we can transition here to discussion of marijuana and rational basis review.
Absolutely. Two things you thought would never go together, right?
That's IJ's wheelhouse. Right? Yeah.
Maybe I should litigate like you guys litigate them. So this is a decision written by Judge Sachs. I'm pleased to read it. And I think, you know, it is written in a very hallmark of his style, which is very eloquent. He doesn't use simple words, but he does manage to communicate a complicated topic very simply and efficiently, I think, which is something that I really took to heart in clerking for him. So this is a criminal narcotics case, a narcotics conspiracy case. It's an affirmance from the Western District of New York. It was not as divisive as the other two cases that we've discussed tonight. This is a unanimous majority opinion, no dissent, no concurrence. And essentially, the facts are pretty straightforward. Two brothers, the Green brothers, were convicted of conspiracy to distribute marijuana, I think sentenced to 2 and 4 years, respectively. The facts are not the interesting part. I think their legal argument is the interesting part. This is very far outside my own wheelhouse, but I do think it's a real example of very smart creative lawyering, so I like to read it. And what the case is essentially about is, a dressed-up administrative challenge that is transformed into a constitutional challenge. And that's an issue that that the judges wrestle with as a threshold issue in the decision. And essentially what the Green brothers argued is that, so stepping back for a moment, they're convicted of narcotics conspiracy, conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance. And under the Controlled Substances Act, there are four schedules in declining degree of severity on which drugs are listed. Schedule one is the most severe, so to speak, the most dangerous drugs, and it lists marijuana on that schedule. And one of the statutory criteria for listing a drug on Schedule one is that it have no currently accepted medical use. Something that I'm sure a lot of people in today's day and age would debate still applies to marijuana. And so the Green brothers argued that the scheduling of marijuana on Schedule one is unconstitutional because there is no rational basis to conclude that it meets the statutory criteria, meaning there's no rational basis to conclude that it has no currently accepted medical use. That was their argument. And the judges take issue with that in the same way that the district court did. And the meat of the holding really revolves around whether, you know, kind of this somewhat tortured issue of whether technical noncompliance with the statute renders something unconstitutional. But before they get there, they deal with two threshold issues, which I think are equally interesting. The first being whether there's a failure of jurisdiction because this is essentially a dressed-up administrative challenge masquerading as a constitutional challenge. And the judges do, you know, I think pretty plainly admit that the ordinary way to challenge the classification of a drug on the schedules is to go through the administrative process. And if you make an administrative challenge to the agency and you lose, it goes straight to the circuit court, meaning that the district court would not have jurisdiction to hear it. So the government essentially argued that the district court was without jurisdiction to hear this, and the circuit court said no. Although, you know, the ordinary way for challenging the scheduling or descheduling of a drug like marijuana would be an administrative challenge, this was nonetheless properly formulated as a constitutional challenge, that they're not, you know, these are mutually exclusive things. Just because it could have been done as administrative challenge does not mean that it had to be done as administrative challenge, and that the brothers had properly stated a constitutional claim, however, you know, however misguided. That's my editorializing of what they said, but it's pretty close. And you know, one of the things that was, I think, notable in the panel's discussion of this was that they noted that the brothers were not asking them to reclassify marijuana on a different schedule. They were simply asking the court to strike marijuana from the schedules altogether as unconstitutionally placed on Schedule One and leave it to the legislature to reschedule as and how appropriate. And I think that's one of the factors that saved the jurisdictional infirmity and, you know, frankly, another hallmark of pretty smart and creative lawyering. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, this definitely struck me as well as a case where we have nothing left to lose here. Like, they yes. caught us with our hand in the cookie jar, so let's make an interesting argument. And they definitely do that here. I wonder, I mean, the scheduling thing is itself a weird delegation process. And so you have Congress passing the Controlled Substances Act and initially scheduling things. But then it delegates that authority to the Attorney General, who delegates it to the DEA, who is now in charge in the first instance of scheduling drugs. But marijuana stayed there the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so do you think that this case might have been viewed differently if Congress hadn't set the schedule at all, but instead had delegated that authority entirely, and then a year later, the DEA had put marijuana in Schedule One? Or is that just completely outside the relevance of what we're dealing with here?
I don't know. You know, technically, I think it's probably outside the relevance. I don't know how influential that kind of differentiation and process would have been on the court. You know, it is interesting to note, and the majority goes through, or not the majority, the decision goes through this, that Congress apparently initially put marijuana on Schedule 1 as some sort of tentative recommendation. But somehow it just stayed there. And you might conclude from that that, you know, times have changed and it should no longer be on it. But the decision does note that, you know, there have been many administrative challenges to the scheduling of marijuana on Schedule 1, some as recent, I think, as 2016 or 2018, right, where some of the laws around marijuana use and distribution had started to change, and I think it's fair to say public sentiment had changed by then. And the administrative petitions for rescheduling were rejected even then. And so, you know, it is kind of an interesting procedural history of how it ended up on there, but it seems to have withstood scrutiny in several different forms of attack, even up to recent times.
Well, I'm glad you brought up scrutiny, because I do want to talk about rational basis here. But I have to point out that I'm not terribly surprised that in 2018 or whenever it was that the DEA itself didn't agree to move marijuana down or schedule it. So I think there might be a bias there in play. But here, let's talk about the impact that rational basis played here. I'll just read a quote here about how this interesting court doctrine works. Here, the circuit says, rational basis review asks not whether it is reasonable to conclude that the specific criteria in the statute have been met, but rather whether there is any conceivable basis that might support the classification. So, do you think if the rational basis test wasn't the standard here and we were just kind of weighing this in more of a 50-50 way, that there's a potential the outcome would be different?
Yes, I do. I don't know if that outcome would have been different necessarily at the circuit court versus in an administrative process, but I think the decision even notes, you know, even if this scheduling wouldn't and shouldn't have withstood challenge through an administrative petition, which properly challenges, you know, the necessity of the scheduling on the scheduling criteria, that still doesn't mean it's unconstitutional under rational basis review. Now, had stricter scrutiny applied, would the circuit court have felt more free to get into the merits of that issue? Yes. I don't know if it would have been outcome determinative, but certainly, yes, you know, rational basis review is an extremely, extremely deferential standard, and that's what you see at play here clearly, you know, and I mean, I think the opinion even notes, you know, that the Green brothers made kind of a half-hearted attempt at stricter scrutiny in the district court, and by the time they got to the appellate court, they put some footnote in saying, like, we reserve the right to argue this, and never did, because, like, even they couldn't make that argument with a straight face.
Can I address that?
Yes, please.
You know, so they make an equal protection argument, and it's sort of mocked by the district judge, who says, marijuana has no equal protection rights,
right.
You know, only people have equal protection rights. But and then they relegate to a footnote the court about footnote 8. They failed to show that marijuana's inclusion on Schedule 1 was motivated by discriminatory intent.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were a law clerk, I would, you know, rather than spending my time on those other two opinions, writing the appendix about, you know, whatever, I would say. Could, you know, not me, because I'm, you know, in my 60s, but I would say, are you kidding? Everybody knows that the history of cannabis regulation is racist. And all you have to do is Google marijuana, racism, and, you know, criminalization, and you will find a ton of books written about how it was directed at, you know, Mexicans who were bringing cannabis across the border, and why, you know, why do we regulate marijuana one way and alcohol not another way? It was the associated with jazz. I mean, you know, and that went all the way through to the 1970 Act that put it on Schedule 1. So that's maybe it still doesn't make it out an equal protection claim, but still it's imbued with racism. Why aren't they talking about that as long as you're writing, you know, little appendices?
As long as I still get my citation, I'm good, Bruce. I can write about that.
Well, you're right. I mean, they do wave it away with almost no discussion at all in footnote 2 there. They say, essentially, that the Green brothers' racial classification arguments that marijuana scheduling was racially motivated and imposes an outsized burden on people of color failed because they could not establish that Congress acted with invidious discriminatory purpose. But there's no more discussion of that point, even though, it, like you said, it's been the subject of books and admissions by the Nixon White House staff and all sorts of other things like that.
And my other rational basis question is this. So they say, we could posit reasons why you might put marijuana on the strictest schedule. But they don't say we could posit reasons why we'd put marijuana on a schedule that's ostensibly of drugs that have no medical use. When half the states have legalized medical marijuana, Congress won't fund the U.S. government, Justice Department, to go after people for marijuana possession, and the Justice Department doesn't want to go after them. So why is the rational basis test about whether it's, you know, on the strictest schedule and not on the non-medicinal use schedule? They don't really explain that.
No, they don't at all. And I think they do. They do kind of a dodge of that as well. I think, you know, in terms of really crafting the opinion as a threshold procedural issue, where the constitutional answer to this question may be different than the administrative answer to this question. I think that's kind of how they dodge it. You know, they seem to say, look, if you were to challenge this again through the administrative process, maybe you'd win, because it does seem like it shouldn't be on that schedule because it can't quite meet that one criteria. But that's not in our purview to decide because of this very deferential rational basis standard.
And that shows the difference between your judge and Judge Calabresi.
Exactly.
Because your judge did not write a concurrence to his own opinion.
Correct.
If only. I think that's a great place to end here as we talk about the confusion created by the rational basis test. But I want to thank all of our panelists for being here today. This has been a great discussion, and thank all of you who are listening to the podcast and who are listening here in person, and remind you all to get engaged. Thank you.